Hello and welcome to Queer Ear. I'm Rory Boyle and you're listening to the Transmission Roundhouse podcast that leaves no stone unturned and no wig unsnatched by shining a light and sometimes throwing a little shade on topics that you don't always hear enough about in the mainstream media. On Queer Ear, we always spill the LGBT. So if you like what you hear, please do rate us 5 stars or leave a review on Apple or hit that follow button on Spotify or wherever you're listening. It takes 10 seconds and always leaves the biggest smile on my queer face. You know, I've never been somebody who's enjoyed school or being in a classroom, and on previous episodes of this podcast, we've looked at both the queer experience of PE and also the lack of queer inclusive sex ed, which we spoke about on our last episode and perhaps has coloured my experience of education. But of course, I do think that knowledge is power, and given that education is a basic human right, I believe it's something we're all more than entitled to. However, one place where human needs often fall by the wayside is prison, and a recent Amnesty article highlighting the struggles of prisoners forgotten in the COVID-19 pandemic has really made me think about how coronavirus could be making life behind bars even harder than normal for queer people. Now, one thing I have seen prisoners often speak out about, whether that be in news articles, books, or documentaries, is how education has gotten them through the hard times. So it warmed my heart to discover Inside and Out, a book that features the first-hand accounts of those incarcerated in the UK who also identify as LGBTQ. The book was compiled by Phil Forder, an art teacher who spent significant time working at HMC Park Prison in Wales.
I've always known I was gay, always, ever since I can remember, which was very difficult growing up in a homophobic family in Essex on a council estate. I don't think I ever even spoke to another gay person until, you know, much, much later in my life. It's very weird, but I always knew, I always had this image in my head, even as a young teenager, that I'd end up working in prison. I don't know why. It's always been there and it's not in my history at all. My dad was absolutely right when he used to say to me, "You're going to end up in prison one day." He was right, but not in the way he thought.
So that was Phil himself, and we'll be hearing a bit more about his 20 plus years experience of prison reform and why access to education is so instrumental to those locked up in just a moment. And later in the episode, we'll also be hearing from Dalton Harrison. He's a public speaker, writer, poet, and trans rights in prison advocate who spent time behind bars and now passionately fights for access to education for prisoners and can also give us a huge insight on how COVID-19 is shaping prison life. But first, back to Phil Forder. From challenging his workplace's condom and sex policy to coming out to the prisoners he was working with, it's safe to say that Phil has been fearless in his choices and has played an intricate role in reform and representation for queer prisoners. So I wanted to start our conversation by asking him what inspired his work in the first place.
I actually thought, I want to teach people who are not privileged, who haven't got these opportunities. And I ended up going into the prison to teach art. I ended up staying there for 20 years. I actually did a life sentence. I found myself battling with the system. You know, I was quite rebellious in the prison service. I taught on the wing, not in a classroom. I always thought that was much better. And I always believed that by sitting on the wing, having the men around me, people would walk by and they would join in and I'd get to know them and we'd sit and talk, and barriers were being broken down, which sometimes actually the officers on the wing didn't like that. They always thought, you know, you were like fraternising, but you know, we're coming at prison work from a totally different perspective in those days.
To have that kind of relationship or rapport with the prisoners you were working with is definitely something to be celebrated. But before, you know, you got to that stage where you were building up trust, can you take me into kind of the initial stages of that role? Because, you know, when I think of how prison life is depicted in the media, whether it be on World's Toughest Prisons or something maybe a lot more low rate than that, like Bad Girls, for instance, you know, we don't get the picture that you would be, quote unquote, fraternizing with prisoners. So take me into those early relationships and building up that trust.
People who are in prison, people say it's a cross-section of society. I don't believe that. It's actually not. It's people who have got the world stacked against them. There are all sorts of reasons why you end up in prison, but there's things like substance misuse and dysfunctional families and poverty and poor education, all those sort of things. Those issues I recognise from my upbringing. And I thought, these are the people who grew up with me on the estate. I know these people. It wasn't like, oh my God, I'm dealing with criminals. I didn't think of it like that. I just thought, these are people, you know, and I can deal with them. I can go and talk with them just like you can talk to anybody else. I think the biggest issue, if I'm totally honest, was also the system, was going into a system which was so repressive, and a system which was, when I first went in there, just seemed stacked against you. You know, it was almost like there were people there who didn't want the prisoners to have art lessons. It was almost like, well, what, you know, my wife has to pay for them and goes to evening school. Why should they get it for nothing? You know, and I'm thinking, this is not what it's about. You know, I'm sure your wife does it for recreation. This isn't about recreation. This is a lot more than that, even though it is recreational. There's a lot more to it than that. The officers on the wings were actually putting the most difficult men that they couldn't do anything with in my class. So I'd end up with these guys, and I'm thinking, yeah. I just think art is an incredible medium to actually open up. I wrote a program called The Art of Living. Main difference from that and other programs was that instead of focusing, like, you've got a drug problem, we'll put you on a substance awareness course, or you've got domestic violence, we'll put you on a violence course. It wasn't focusing on what's wrong with you. It's about what's right with you. Because when you come into prison, if you've never been in there before, your self-esteem just goes, you know, through the floor. I set this program up, and I think I must have put about 300 prisoners through that program single-handedly, pretty much. It's life skills. There's no recipe for it. You've got to have that inner conviction that you want to do this sort of work and you want to make a difference. It's not a job. It's more than that. That's how I see it anyway.
I think that's made perfectly clear by what you're saying. You definitely have that mental agility that is required for a role like this. But, you know, it's interesting because you talk about putting 300 people through this program, which is something to be proud of in itself. But then also, you know, your personal pride in your sexuality. I think coming out in your particular environment, again, it requires certain skills and, you know, a certain tenacity. So can you talk about the decision to do
that? It's weird because I was on the verge of coming out when I was a lot younger, and I actually was in a relationship with the first person I ever really fell in love with, I suppose. He actually died of AIDS, which devastated me, and it actually knocked me back in the closet. I ended up getting married and having a child and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, this is how it's going to end for me. And then when I was working in the prison, there were a lot of lesbian women who were officers, but no gay men. And I'm working with men, and part of the way I'm working is I'm asking them to be honest about themselves. I thought, I've got to come out. And it wasn't a decision. It wasn't a conscious decision. It was actually a physical decision. I actually felt, if I don't come out, I'm going to have a breakdown. This is like really affecting me. And, you know, even going by the most conservative estimates of percentage of gay men in the population, we should have had a lot more than we had. I think at the time there were 4 out of like something like 2,500, which is, you know, in total, which is a bit sort of, you know, not quite right. And I said, well, it's because people are frightened. And, you know, when you come into the prison and you're asked in your induction, you'll be asked what your sexual orientation is. You're being asked by a complete stranger in a uniform who's not exactly the most friendly. Are you going to come out and say, I'm gay? Probably not, unless you're uber confident. I mean, the worst thing that could happen is for a gay man to come into the prison and say, I'm straight. They end up in a cell with somebody who's homophobic. That, we don't want that. Yeah, that would be a disaster. So I thought sport is a great thing because everybody and all the prisoners want to do sport. They're all into their sport, you know, working out. So I thought the next thing I'm going to do is in Cardiff, we have the Cardiff Dragons gay football team. And I thought, I'll invite them in to come and play a football match with the prisoners. I thought, there's a big ask. And I didn't tell the prisoners they were gay. And then I got the chairman to stand up and say why we exist. And he said, you know, we exist because as gay men, we didn't feel welcome in the sort of local football clubs. And these prisoners were going, what, are you all gay? And there was this great big bloke sitting next to me, this big prisoner, and he leaned over and he whispered in my ear, and I'm going to take this with me to the grave, he whispered in my ear and he said, they don't look gay. Which just made me roar. I don't know what he was expecting. I don't know what a gay man looks like, but it wasn't. I think he was expecting 11 Boy Georges to be running around or something. I also invited in Swansea Vikings, which is a gay rugby team, and they also really don't look gay. I just thought, I'm just going to keep building this up, building this up, building this up through sport.
Phil, you know, here you are, you've got rugby players, these football players. If I'm gay in prison and I like men in uniform, this is like paradise for me right now. So there definitely deserves to be some sort of honour in your name. But I think we should wrap things up by talking about the book. It's such a big array of different experiences. It's called Inside and Out. And I just want you to tell everybody about that book and what it entailed.
I asked gay staff to write down their experiences of coming out. And then I also asked gay prisoners to write their experiences of coming out and put them all together in a book. And what was interesting was they were all pretty much the same. It built a bit of a bridge between the gay staff and the gay prisoners. We were getting transgender prisoners coming into the prison. The prison service was a million miles behind how to manage transgender prisoners and what their rights were on a day-to-day level. It took them a year and a half to produce something which was so overdue. I mean, we were having to make it up as we went along, and everyone's terrified of doing it wrong. And I thought, this is crazy. On the strength of the book of Inside and Out, I thought, I'm going to go around as many prisons in the UK that will let me in that have transgender prisoners. And I sat in cell with transgender prisoners. And I said, just said to them, if I had a magic wand and I could give it to you, what would you change? What would make life easier for you? And I talked to trans prisoners at all different stages of transitioning, all different ages. And they all pretty much said the same thing. It was like to be treated with respect and to be allowed to present in the way I want to present. And so I wrote down all their stories. And so Inside and Out is half of the book, really. The other half of the book is interviews with transgender prisoners. And I called that Released Inside. And that's also free on the internet. So if you look them up, they're there.
So I couldn't recommend taking a look at both of those books more, because while Phil's work is beyond incredible, it's so important that we also hear from those who have spent time in prison behind bars and identify as queer.
It wasn't accepted. If you so much as declared yourself as LGBT, you'd get a slap straight away. Those were the sort of guidelines that people were following in society at that point. So for me, anything LGBT, anything that was remotely different from everyone else was dangerous. And that's how I grew up, basically. Right up until my 30s, I still held that sort of society value. To survive, you've just got to be, you know, in stealth.
That's the voice of Dalton Harrison, a public speaker, writer, poet, and trans rights in prison advocate. As someone who spent his early years hiding who he really was, Dalton's life has done a complete 180 in recent times. In November 2020, he gave a searingly honest account of his time in prison for a Pink News article which highlighted his horrific treatment as a trans man living in a woman's prison, and why education and reinvesting in prisoners is vital. One of the key points that I picked up from my conversation with Phil was that he wanted to help those who were less privileged than him. And as we know, trans people are still hugely marginalized, even within our own queer community. So I wanted to hear how Dalton thinks this can be tackled. But first, I wanted him to take me into his lived experience of being placed in a women's prison and what that meant to him as a trans man.
Well, my first fear was having to get changed in front of other women. That was the first impact of I'm going to be around other women. And people just looked at me like I was insane, like, well, what's the problem? And I'm like, well, you don't really see me, so we're not on the same page here. And that was straight away.
So that was the fear. But then, of course, there's the reality. There's, you know, the moment that you do step into the prison for the first time. And that sounded from your article like it was really tough, some of the stuff you had to face. So can you take me into those initial moments and initial days and what you were facing at that time?
It was just surviving. I just went into a sort of daze. I mean, the first person that I told was in reception, the nurse that do tests on you. And in the days of all those procedures and paperwork being filled in, I said, I'm transgender. And she's like, what do you want me to do about it? Get a doctor. And that was the exact words. And I was just frozen, like, right, I'm a prisoner now. So that's obviously the way it is. So I've got to shut up and get on with it. From that moment to obviously the next, it just spiraled for me.
A medical professional who reacts like that, it's pretty awful to say the least. Although, to be honest, in some ways, perhaps not surprising when we do hear some stories that trans people have when it comes to dealing with medical professionals. Do you think that that was somebody who, simply put, just didn't care? Or is that sort of a general mindset we see across people working in prisons, that they haven't been trained properly, there's lack of education, and therefore that can often lead to transphobia?
Yeah, I mean, she was probably tired. I was probably the fourth, fifth person in the last hour she'd had to deal with. Maybe she wasn't thinking straight at that point. But you've got to think professionally, because that person could have gone and killed themselves. And that was a very stark reality that I met in prison. People constantly trying to attempt suicide. In the first month of me being in, there were four people that tried to attempt suicide in front of me. So this was a reality, not just for transgender people, but for anyone in the prison system. You know, to have that sort of neglect for their personal situation, to just be swiped under like that, that can destroy people.
And you yourself, you know, you were going through such a hard time that you did question whether it would be better if you were dead. You know, being in that sort of headspace is so heavy and so tough. How did you get through it?
I was just blanking out a lot. I couldn't seem to focus on anything. I just thought, well, I've committed a crime. I've been sent to prison. This is what everyone wants, for me to be punished, for me to suffer. So I should just suck it up. I never thought maybe there should be a level of humanity. Maybe there should be kindness, even if somebody has committed a crime. We're all humans at the end of the day.
One thing that I think trans prisoners face a lot, it's something I've seen in the press a lot about anybody who, let's say, identifies as male and they want to transfer to a male prison, having been placed in a female prison, is that they'll be told they're looking for special treatment. It's almost laughable that somebody would think that way, because in my eyes, it's not special treatment at all. It's the treatment that a human being deserves. So what do you say to this notion of special treatment, or, you know, somebody causing problems or perhaps trying to re-identify in order to gain some sort of benefits? What's your message to people who think that way?
There's nothing in the prison system to me that can be of benefit. I mean, you're lucky if you get a nice, decent meal. You don't, to be honest, but you're lucky if you get a meal half the time. I've gone to the dining hall where you get your food and they've been like, oh, we've run out. It's that sort of environment where people are surviving on a basic level. They always see anything that's different as special treatment. They see education as special treatment. I've had people shouting at me when I say, well, I'm trying to get to my study group. Oh, who do you think you are? Get into your study group. Just get in line with everyone else. You're not on the list. And it's that environment where people are constantly being stopped from doing anything. And that's, you know, where I'm worried about what's happening to people in prison at the moment, you know, and during COVID, that the problem's just escalated.
We'll talk about, you know, how we could maybe fix some of those problems in just a moment. But, you know, one other thing that I want to speak about is the fact that you've said, I was the only trans prisoner who hadn't been accused of sexual assault. So Can you explain how prevalent those accusations are and how prevalent sexual assault is in prison in general?
I've seen a lot of people that were saying that they'd been assaulted in some ways, and I totally believe them, and other people didn't. And I've seen other people that have been accused of it just because they're trans, and that person wanted to get out of the relationship. So instead of dumping them like you would anybody else, you think, right, this is my easy clause. I can not only get them in trouble, I can get them off the wing and away from me so I can start a relationship easily with somebody else.
From my point of view, it sounds like when you're in there, you know, you're just living in fear and panic and survival mode. Can you tell me about what the biggest changes are that need to happen and how we can actually go about making those?
It's about actually saying there is a problem. I mean, when I was going to my transgender meetings, they said I was lucky to have them, that most prisoners don't bother having a meeting where they discuss with the prisoner, you know, issues that they have. And the issues that I said that I had, they said, well, that doesn't happen anymore. And I said, but it does. I do get misgendered. And then I showed them my movement slip, which is something that you have to have if there's free flow where you can move between rooms. It said miss on it. And I said, well, this is the problem you're saying doesn't exist. And I've been here over a year and you're saying this problem doesn't exist. And that's where they just stopped and they were like, ah.
Why do you think they are, you know, denying that these problems exist so much? Is it pure laziness and not wanting to deal with it? Or is it just a complete ignorance to some of these issues?
I think some of it's ignorance. Another part is that there's so many problems in the prison justice system at the moment. They've got a barrage of stuff coming in and out that they just can't deal with on a day-to-day basis. So stuff gets ignored.
So let's talk about the fact that we are living in such strange times at the moment. COVID has affected pretty much everything in our day-to-day lives. And of course, it will have had an effect on prisoners as well. Do you have an idea of what that's like, you know, living in prison during COVID times and how that might be affecting trans prisoners? And ultimately, again, some of the changes we could make there.
I mean, at the moment, I've had letters from people that I was friends with on the inside that are still transitioning. And they're saying to me in the letters that it's worse than ever. Not only prisoners, but as well as staff are just reverting back to old behaviours. And everything that we fought for has just seemed to have been put back on the back burner. I often believe that the only information coming into prisons that prisoners can read are in the papers. And if people are being negative towards trans people in the papers, then that spirals into the prison system because that's the only information. They can't Google anything. They can't get access to internet or other materials. So what they're reading on the headlines about trans lives and how much they matter, it totally affects everything that's happening in there right now.
It's almost human nature, unfortunately, that we like to define people very easily by certain things, by certain events they've been through, by the way they identify. One quote from you that really stuck with me from your article was, "I had spent my whole life fighting other people's ideas of me." So I just want to know, now that you've been through this unique experience, where you are now in terms of your identity and, you know, your own personal headspace?
It's an ongoing struggle, definitely. I mean, I've definitely come out the other side. I've seen a lot of friends that I had fail. I've even bumped into people in the street where they're at rock bottom and I know they're going back into prison. To me, I know how blessed I am that I've managed to stay motivated. And that's where education comes into it, because my motivation that I picked up in prison, I've carried that on and got accepted into university. It's given me that solid foundation.
So as Dalton's just told us, education has given him the foundation to kickstart the next chapter of his life, and I couldn't be happier for him. And Phil's also made it abundantly clear that his work teaching art has not only opened up the minds of his students, but it's also what built up intimate trust and ultimately led to him coming out in his workplace. Whether it's Orange is the New Black or I Love You, Philip Morris, we see all kinds of depictions of queer life while locked up in the mainstream media. But one thing that Hollywood has continually left out is the power that education holds to those who spent time on the inside. So my message to you is this. No matter how you feel about those who've been convicted of a crime, they are still human beings who deserve to learn. Instead of focusing on shows and films that sensationalize the prison experience by showing us the really tough and gritty side of what that can look like, let's change the narrative, because while the tough, gritty experience is valid, we need to humanize these people as well. We need to actively help those who have less privilege than us, who are facing next level vitriol behind bars, because at the end of the day, many of these prisoners are queer, and it would be truly criminal not to care about their experiences and their access to education and ultimately bettering themselves. That's nearly it from me. If you like what you heard, please do rate us 5 stars or leave a review on Apple, or hit that follow button on Spotify or wherever you're listening. If you want to join the conversation on our social media, I'm at Mr. Rory Boyle, and this podcast is at Queer Ear Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. All that's left to say is that I've been Rory Boyle, and thank you for getting it in gear, keeping it here, and listening to Queer Ear.
You're listening to Transmission Roundhouse.